Hi, I'm Andre Greenwald, head of public policy at VIA. Welcome to The Dispatch, a podcast series in which we interview leaders in transportation. I'm really excited today to be joined by Gabe Klein, who is the co-founder of Cityfy, which works with city leaders, CEOs, and other stakeholders to understand the complexity of 21st century challenges and to facilitate people-centric solutions. Gabe previously served as the commissioner of both the Chicago and Washington, D.C. Departments of Transportation, not at the same time. When I first started at VIA, several of my Obama White House colleagues advised me to seek Gabe's counsel. And I began that by reading his excellent book, Startup City. It's been great to get to know him over the last few years. He's truly one of our nation's leading voices on urban mobility. Thank you for joining me, Gabe.
Oh, well, thanks so much. That's very kind of you and nice to be here on the show.
Great. For those of listening who may be unfamiliar with Cityfy, can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. So as you said, I was in government for a number of years. Before that, I was in startups and transportation technology companies. And much of that was pre-iPhone, actually, which was really interesting. But when I came out of government, I realized that there weren't a lot of people like me that had gone from public to, or private to public and back. And that there was a real need for public, private, in some cases, philanthropy, nonprofits to work together to make, you know, big consequential change that we need in cities around environment and upward mobility and equity and all of these things. And so after writing my book, Startup City, I had some like-minded compatriots that also had worked in government in the private sector. And they said, how can we make, you know, more change in cities? How can we assist? And so we started this firm, which we say does urban change management, which always sort of confuses people. But I think now during COVID times, people do understand it. So we help basically cities and companies figure out all the levers of change and how to navigate. And a lot of the work is mobility. Some of it is technology and smart cities, but it's all based around human-centered design.
Great. I wanted to ask you about a op-ed that you penned in the Washington Post in June, where you talked about how we need to reckon with the racist policies that have shaped our cities over the years. And you're known as someone, as one of your legacies, you were one of the people who launched two of the first and largest bike share systems in the United States, in both Chicago and DC. And so from that context, I thought this line really jumped out at me and I thought was important. You write, quote, building just, healthy, and inclusive cities requires far more than protected bike lanes and alfresco dining. We cannot fulfill plans for safer, cleaner, more sustainable cities without addressing the racialized history of redlining and the modern segregation that allows inequality to thrive. Can you talk us through that a little bit and expand on it?
Yeah, so, you know, look, different people feel differently when they start to see amenities show up in their city. You know, for you or I, we might be like, oh, it's so great that we have a bike lane in our neighborhood. And for somebody else, it might be a signal that this is the first step in moving them out of the neighborhood. I'm not somebody that believes that we can't have nice things, you know, because of some unintended consequence. What I believe in is dealing with the underlying issue so you don't have the unintended consequence. I actually think, and I posit in this op-ed, that the people that are enduring sort of the worst commutes and the worst impacts of the current system that we have are often minority populations, right? Because if you go back to the 1950s and 60s when we built freeways, you know, through people's neighborhoods, you and I both live in Washington, D.C., and you can come in on 295, that ran through people's homes, people of color. And so those lines of segregation have continued. The redlining is historic. And if we're going to heal those wounds, it's not enough to just throw some options in for people. You have to deal with the housing issues as well. You have to deal with the issues of communication and outreach and people understanding and you actually making it so that these options are for them. They're not an afterthought, which means involving people in the process. It means, you know, not having a bunch of, you know, white people putting in solutions for people of color. It means involving people in those decisions. in where they go and how they go in. And in some cases, like in Chicago, I decided not to put bike sharing into some of these neighborhoods until the people in the neighborhoods came to us and said, no, we're ready for it. We want it. And here's how we want it.
That's great. You mentioned, commuting time and the importance of that, right? It's hard to, housing policy is really important. It's also hard to climb the economic ladder or access jobs if you can't get to those jobs or get to those interviews in an affordable, convenient way. So later in your piece, you say when commuting time is shortened, this is a quote, when commuting time is shortened by efficient transit, it increases people's odds of escaping poverty. So how do we actually do that? How do we make transit more efficient, make it easier for people to access jobs? And I'm curious if you think that certain innovations like on-demand transit or otherwise have a role to play in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I think that we measure the wrong things. I mean, on the car side, we measure like level of service, how fast are we moving vehicles through intersections? And on the transit side, it's often like, well, are we reaching enough people? Are we providing enough service? But we're not necessarily looking at, sometimes we're looking at, okay, how often is it coming? But are we looking at how many jobs people are able to reach in a community, right? Are we looking at upward mobility, or are we just looking at mobility? Are we looking at being able to give people access to the things that they need in a time frame that they need? And are we looking at the quality of the trip, meaning that everybody is getting the same quality of trip? And yes, I think microtransit, for instance, can be really helpful, particularly in areas where you don't have transit, where it's a transit desert and it's challenged because it may not make sense to run 15-minute headways in an area where you just don't have the density, for instance, to justify the service, or you need to build the service. And so we've got to be much more flexible. I'm not somebody that believes that, like, the bus is the only way or the bike is the only way. We need to let people tell us what they want. And I think the best way to do that is by showing them what's possible and then see if they vote with their feet.
That's great. And I'm glad you mentioned, metrics and how we measure these things. I get the sense, I don't know if you agree, that there's a little bit of a growing consensus that we are not basing our transportation and transit funding decisions on the best or the correct metrics, and that we need to start measuring things like equity and economic mobility, and not to set aside the complication of coming up with exactly what the right metrics are and how to measure it, because I think that's a very important conversation. But I think also important to note there's a difference between theorizing about it and then actually coming up with the answer and actually getting it done. And so I'd love to talk about that second part, because you're someone who actually ran two transportation departments who got a lot of things done that that were not so easy to get through. I mean, how do we actually, from a political and bureaucratic level, get these metrics into how we actually do transportation funding and make our decisions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I think we have to stop looking at things in silos. One of the points I make in the op-ed and in some other pieces I've written in Forbes as well is that, we've got to look at the fully loaded social cost benefit of the investments that we're making. And that means looking beyond, like, is this person, do they have decent transportation? It's really about like health and happiness and sustainability and job access. Like, what are the things that we feel like are basic human rights that people should have? If we feel like it's a basic human right and there's an intersection with mobility, home ownership, not that everybody needs to own a home, but having a place to live that's in proximity to where you want to work, then let's start measuring these things more broadly. And so I'm a big proponent of looking at a long-term 30-year plus outcome and impact ROI versus just looking at political wins or looking at very short-term ROI. And so we've actually at City5 built this fully loaded social cost benefit model, and we're constantly iterating on it. But at the end of the day, it's probably more akin to the World Happiness Report than it is to just looking at GDP. And I think where we're heading as a society is a place where we're going to need to meet more people's basic needs. And I think there's a sort of recalibration of what basic needs are. And I think mobility is a basic need. And the more that we push people out of the cities and we push them to places where they need cars, then we're creating more and more of a problem, which is why you can't just look at mobility without land use and affordability.
Yeah. Do you think COVID-19 and everything that's happening now makes it more challenging to do what you're describing, or actually presents a bit of an opportunity for an important set of rethinks on this?
That's a great question. And I mean, I think if you think about this year, in some sense, it's like this lost year, right? It's like this lost year of productivity and so many things. But it's also a year where people are stopping and thinking. And like, you know, what happened to George Floyd? And, you know, I wonder if in normal times we would have stopped and really analyzed that. Or we would have said, oh, you know, it's another case of this happening. And so, you know, I think that COVID, with all the calamity that we're facing and the unnecessary negative outcomes that we're seeing because of a lack of a consistent strategy across the country, it is, like all things that are bad, an opportunity to reassess, you know, are we investing in the right things? Are we thinking the right way? Are we ready for the change that's coming? And it seems like we're not. And if so, maybe we need to stop and recalibrate on a lot of levels. And I think people are personally looking at their beliefs when it comes to systemic, you know, racism and privilege. And I think they're looking around themselves and thinking like, are these things good for society? You know, are giant SUVs for people to drive a mile good? Should we be sharing more? Should we be sharing rides? Should we be riding our bikes? You know, why do we have more homeless people now? Why can't we have sort of a basic social support structure for people? And so in that way, I hope that we do re-examine. Who knows, maybe there'll be a change in political leadership nationally this year. It usually happens every so often. And it might be an opportunity for a bigger national conversation that actually results in some positive outcomes.
On the subject of giant SUVs, transportation, as you know, is the number one cause of greenhouse gas emissions in America. And I don't know if you have this sense. I have a sense that in the policymaker community, there's so much focus on electric and zero emissions vehicles, which is obviously critically important, but I think is also by itself not sufficient to address the climate crisis in the transportation sector. So curious if you agree with that assessment. And you touched on this a little bit in your last answer, but curious what you think we need to do in addition to electrifying vehicles.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I think, you know, as somebody that has a Tesla Model 3 and really thinks like, hey, it's a contribution in some sense. But the reality is that the CO2 emitted to produce my car is worse than the emissions coming out of to operate an SUV over the life of the vehicle. And so we need to be honest with the data. And we have a problem in this country. We have a problem worldwide, but particularly in this country, with just raw consumption, right? And so whether it's, you know, throwaway shirts from Old Navy or building really fancy cars that use, you know, 20 tons of rare metals to produce just the microchips to make them work. My car is a lot better off if 25, 30 people are sharing it. And that starts to look like a microtransit vehicle, right? So, you know, I think some of the issues that we face, Andre, are cultural around this idea of individual freedom and liberty. And I actually wrote about that recently in Forbes as well. And the fact that, like, we think that we have the right to drive alone and to do what we want and not wear a mask and, like, all this stuff because we're Americans, because we're still, like, fighting the British in some weird way, right? And the reality is our friends just over the border in Canada ride all over the place in buses, in streetcars in Toronto, and they wear masks and they've killed COVID because they have more of a collectivist mentality, because they see themselves as more European. So maybe being number one all the time And maybe being so singularly focused on one person, ourselves all the time, is not the recipe for a good commute or a good environment or a happy society.
We are sadly out of time. Gabe, it's been great to learn from you yet again. Thank you so much for joining us. I encourage everyone who tuned into our chat with Gabe to check out even more of our interviews with transit leaders around the world. And that is the end of this dispatch. Thanks, Gabe.
Thanks for having me, Andre.